Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. It's hard to believe, but this week marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The impact of what transpired that morning can never be understated. And first and foremost, the lives lost, those terribly wounded, and the families directly impacted by tragedy and the physical damage, the direct impact was tremendous in scale and almost unimaginable in scope. And as the months transpired, America entered a series of military operations whose scale and duration continue to impact us today. The impact of these conflicts at an individual and national level is sobering. And that reality is particularly poignant given the events in Afghanistan in recent weeks. But the events of 9/11 and beyond, while they are enveloped in grief and tragedy, also saw tremendous acts of selfless bravery with Americans doing what they've done for generations, recognizing there are things that matter more than their individual safety and running headlong into danger to execute key missions, defend another life, or to help turn the tide when the chips are down and the odds were bleak. Simply put, that is the American spirit. Now, it's cliche that we all remember where we were on the morning of 9/11, and it's true. And I sure remember where I was. I was in my dorm room at Randolph Air Force Base going through the Introduction to Fighter Fundamentals course, which is a short course after a fighter pilot earns their wings to hone some basic fighter pilot skills. And I had two sorties left in the syllabus, and I was flying the second go. So I actually was up in the morning eating breakfast, and I said something to myself that my grandfather would say to me almost every morning. He would turn on the news and say, "Hey, let's see what's going on in the world today." And when I said that to myself and I turned on the TV, I watched the second plane hit the World Trade Center. And I knew at that moment, the world was going to change. And I quickly called the squadron. And initially they said, "Stay put." And then about 5 minutes later, I got the call, "Hurry up and get to work. We all might be flying." And that says a lot about the impact that terror attacks had on all of us, from the most junior lieutenant to the senior most general and beyond. And that's how we're going to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11, by speaking with three individuals who began that day as just another Tuesday, and in a matter of hours, they were thrust into situations they could have never imagined. As with so many of us, they would never be the same again. So with that, I'd like to introduce General John Jumper, the 17th Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. He had just taken command of the Air Force on September 6th, and with the attacks forever changing what his tenure would be like. In fact, September 11th was his first full day at work as the Chief of Staff. So, General, welcome.
Thank you, Slick. It's a pleasure to be here and join this group.
And we also have Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General David Deptula, who was a major general back then, and he was heading up the Air Force's Quadrennial Defense Review, congressionally mandated strategy assessment, and was just two corridors away from where the American Airlines 767 impacted the Pentagon.
Hey, it's great to be back, Slick.
And finally, representing the flight line perspective, we have our own Heather Penny, who was a brand new lieutenant at the 121st Fighter Squadron and took to the sky that morning to execute the air defense mission.
Hey, Slick, happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. And I know it's a difficult subject. General Jumper, I want to get started with you. You had just been sworn in as the Chief of Staff of the Air Force on September 6th. So if there was any or ever a Pearl Harbor type of moment in modern history, you found yourself in the middle of it that morning. So to set the stage here, how would you describe things as you woke up on September 11th? What was the national mood like? What were the top concerns in the Department of Defense? And what were your top concerns as a new Chief of Staff at this point?
Well, that's there's a lot on everybody's mind, of course, globally. I think just as a nation, we were certainly aware of weapons of mass destruction, and we were waking up to religious radicalism. We've been through the Kosovo crisis, in 1999. We were certainly aware of the emerging power of China, but I think as on the world stage, we kind of thought these were all issues that were to be managed. They may have been on everyone's mind, but not at a critical level. there was a global awareness, a rising global awareness, but Friedman hadn't published his book about, you know, the world is flat until 2005. So there wasn't this sort of global unification mentality. And of course, as the Air Force is concerned, our airmen had just been through a great demonstration of air power and combined operations with our allies in Kosovo in 1999. So we were pretty proud of ourselves and on top of the world at that point. So when you woke up that morning, I think there was not any awareness of the way our world was going to change at about 8:46 that same morning.
Sir, thanks for that. And General Deptula, you were assigned to the Pentagon during this period, leading the Air Force's major portion of a major defense review. How did you and your team view the threats facing the nation at this point? And what were your biggest concerns? Was terrorism even on the radar yet?
That's a great question, Slick, as it takes us back to a different time. That was the era of transformation. As General Jumper just mentioned, we just come out of Operation Allied Force, operations over Kosovo. And the Air Force was clearly focused on threats that have since manifested themselves in a big way, especially China. But I went back and dug in my notes last night in preparation and pulled out some of the QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review chart. So here are the Air Force themes for the 2001 QDR. First, modern aerospace capabilities enable change in legacy warfighting. We were talking about alternatives and options like rapid halt, effects-based operations, coercive campaigns, and global reconnaissance strike and an associated concept known as Global Strike Task Force. Two, aerospace capability and employment have defined the revolution in military affairs, and the Air Force is transforming accordingly. Three, and this is kind of an interesting one, capability to defeat anti-access strategies becoming key. Stealth, extended range operations, and at the time, the new Expeditionary Aerospace Force and Air Expeditionary Force construct provide the capability that is fundamental to joint force operations. Four, air and space is one contiguous domain from an operational perspective, aerospace. Five, future total force initiatives solidifying us as one force. And the last one, recapitalization of the air breathing and space force and infrastructure requires major increase in Air Force budget. Some things don't change, do they, General? Now, I'm happy to say that our approach at that time had an impact. For the first time in history of defense reviews, the Air Force got a majority of the money plus up. It was around $9 billion, if my recollection is correct. And General Jumper didn't want us to make a big deal about that appropriately, but that was not an issue as 9/11 occurred as the QDR was reaching endgame. With respect to your second question, the scale of the terrorist threat, I mean, as General Jumper mentioned, yeah, people were thinking about it, but it really was a surprise, and it was not a planning factor during the 2001 QDR.
I really appreciate both of you generals taking us back to where you were on that morning. So General Jumper, could you describe where you were when you first learned of the attack, and how did information get to you? Did you first view this as a national security issue or just a tragic aviation accident?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I get asked that a lot. We were down in the military Air Force Command Center in the basement of the Pentagon. I had been sworn in on the 6th, as you mentioned earlier, but I had to go back to Langley to pack up and move. You can't do anything. The confirmation had come through very quickly, and we weren't sure when that was going to happen, and you can't presume you're going to be confirmed, so we couldn't even pack up our household goods until confirmation came through. So I went back and helped my wife Ellen get that all done. And so this was my first full day of work, and I'm sitting in my very first staff meeting, and we're getting our intelligence briefing, and the briefer gets interrupted and then tells the audience that something's happening in New York, and we turn on CNN. And I remember the first words out of the commentators' mouths that we heard on CNN was it looks like somebody was off course going into LaGuardia. And of course, you have a whole room full of airmen who look at that deep blue sky. You may remember there wasn't a cloud in the sky that day, and say, no, that's not it. And of course, it had taken a few minutes to get that picture up and get the information into the command center. And about that time, the second airplane hit the tower. And then you knew this was not an accident. Intuitively, you knew this was something that was planned. So the information flow, you know, comes to the National Military Command Center and the, into the Air Force Ops Center. And so, you know, we have a flow of information, but the flow of information was more reporting on confusion than anything else, at least initially. Then we heard, of course, that the airplane, an airplane had was headed back toward Washington, D.C., and that's where we sent everybody up to the outside. Everybody in that room had offices on the E-ring. We sent people up to the fourth floor to get people out of their offices areas sort of toward the center of the building. I went up to the Secretary of the Air Force's office, Dr. Roach. He was standing in the window talking on the phone. I didn't know him that well at the time, but I grabbed him by the cuff of his collar and dragged him to the to his front door with him protesting loudly, not knowing what was going on. And about the time we got to the door, the airplane hit the other side of the Pentagon. So those were sort of the first few minutes of my time as Chief of Staff of the Air Force.
It is unbelievable. Well, on the other side of the river, Heather, as I understand it, you were at the squadron when someone stuck their head into a meeting that you were in and announced that a plane had hit the World Trade Center in New York. How did you and your fellow squadron mates react to the news?
Yes, like, so, you know, we're in a meeting. There's no television, no radio. When one of our enlisted troops, David Callahan, again, like you said, just opens up the door, interrupts a meeting and says an airplane hit the World Trade Center. And like General Jumper said, I mean, we all looked outside the windows from the ops building and it was just a crystal blue day. And we thought, how the heck does this happen, you know? And because you just said a plane hit the World Trade Center, we assumed it had to have been some kind of little bug smasher, right? Like a general aviation Cessna going down the Hudson. And everyone knows that those airplanes can't hurt buildings. They bounce off of them. So to be honest, we made a couple inappropriate jokes and got back to business. It wasn't until Chunks came back and said a second aircraft hit the second World Trade Center, it was on purpose, that we got up. We went to the squadron bar where the television was and saw what everyone else saw that morning. And that's when we knew that our nation was under attack. Now, you have to remember, in 2001, I mean, this was, as General Jumper said and General Deptula said, this is, you know, post-Cold War. So in the 1990s, the nation in the search for the peace dividend and reaping all sorts of savings, they literally cut the Air Force in half. So on that morning, although I'm sitting on Andrews Air Force Base in, you know, the capital of the free world, we're not an alert squadron. There were only five alert squadrons ringing the nation, and they were actually still thinking about a Cold War mindset anyways, right? So they're looking out over the oceans and over the poles for, you know, incoming threats. So we were ill-prepared. You know, and not only that, but because we're just a normal fighter squadron, we don't have any missiles. We don't have any armed aircraft at the ready. So, you know, there's not that capability. And the other piece of it too is because we're not an alert squadron and we're a National Guard unit, we don't have the right command and control authorities. So NORAD, when they hit the red button and they scramble their fighters, we're not a unit that gets the call. And as you said, you know, General Jumper mentioned about how chaotic it was. As a National Guard unit, we weren't plugged into the active duty. We didn't have any kind of command and control that went up through there. And as the District of Columbia National Guard, we didn't have a governor either for our civilian chain of command. And our civilian chain of command doesn't go up to the mayor of the district. It goes up to the president of the United States. So we had multiple problems trying to get airborne. We knew that we had to We knew we had to get airborne. We knew we had to protect and defend. But the challenge was getting the appropriate authorization to allow us to do that and building up the missiles that would allow us to be effective.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're traveling in a time machine, bringing us way back to how things were. But one thing that I want to chat with you about is I believe one of the hijackers from Flight 11 out of Boston actually transmitted on the radio about the hijacking, meaning to be speaking to the passengers over the intercom. And this is what led to the fighters in New England being scrambled before any of the planes hit their targets. Do you know anything about this?
No, we didn't. So even though we were, you know, a guard unit, again, we were not connected into NORAD. We were not connected with the active duty. And so what was going on in New England was completely disconnected from us. And you also have to remember that in order to be able to facilitate their rapid response, they had pre-planned flight plans. So those fighters, when they took off, air traffic control clears a corridor for them to go out over the ocean. So that's where all of those guys went. That's where the fighters from Otis went, and that's where the fighters from Norfolk went as well. They go out over the Atlantic, and then they have problems trying to get back in because the FAA has now closed the airspace. We had no information, no intelligence, and so David McNulty, who was our intelligence officer at the time, started doing what we now call open source intelligence. He's calling the FAA, he's making phone calls to air traffic control, and he's making phone calls to airline reservation systems to try to build an air battle picture, to understand what aircraft are airborne, what flights are scheduled when, and trying to figure out where they're at.
Well, General Deptula, you were in the Pentagon at this point with your team. Were you aware of the attacks in New York? And did you have any idea that you were at risk of being struck next? As I understand, and just to recage everybody, the order of events was that the North World Trade Center tower was struck at 8:46 a.m., the South Tower at 9:03 a.m., and then the Pentagon was hit at 9:37 a.m.
Well, Slick, I was in my office that morning, and my deputy, Brigadier General Ron Bath, was coming back from a dental appointment. He called me on the phone and he told me to turn on the TV as a plane had hit the World Trade Center. So I did, and like Heather had mentioned, it was just an absolutely beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky, all up and down the East Coast. So like others, I figured some pilot in a light aircraft had a heart attack and ran into one of the towers. But as I'm watching, and this is, I'm sure it was very similar to what General Jumper relayed, I see the second aircraft hit the second tower and immediately realized, hey, this is no accident. It's an intentional attack. And believe it or not, my next thought was, you know, the Pentagon would make a logical next target. But there wasn't a whole heck of a lot that could be done to prevent that from a seat in the Pentagon. So I went back to my desk and picked back up working on the last update to the chief on our progress on the quadrennial defense review. 30 minutes later, third plane slams into the Pentagon just two quarters away from where I'm at. Now, the system was not designed for this sort of attack. Air defense was aligned to defend against an external threat from a state actor, not a domestically launched terrorist threat of this magnitude. But that's a short rendition for what happened to me there in the opening stages of the attack and in our awareness.
It's interesting to expand on that. I think, Dave, you and Heather both made the point. Our whole air defense system is designed to repel an external threat. And of course, as I speak around the United States, even today, I still get the question about, you know, why weren't we ready to deal with this? And I just paint a little scenario. You know, if I'd had perfect clairvoyance and I had known this was going to happen a month before the event and gone to the Secretary of Defense or my bosses and said, listen, this is going to happen and we need to start today practicing shooting down American airliners in American airspace full of Americans. We ought to start practicing that today. They would have carted me off in a white jacket. So this was an imponderable until it happened, unfortunately. And of course, we've taken steps since then to look at this differently, but just like Heather, Heather's experience, imagine a young lieutenant or captain in an airplane being put in a position and being ordered to shoot down an American airliner in American airspace. It would be a life-altering situation that you put your people in. Just like Heather and her comrades, they would have done exactly what their duty was, but it was not something that we had prepared for, either mentally or in our training.
Well, sir, you bring up a great point. I mean, as I recall, the elevator and the escalator to the Metro went right into the Pentagon. There was no security. So of course these were things that from a structure standpoint, we were just not thinking about from an anti-terrorism perspective. So now I know you've described your initial actions, but putting your chief hat on in the sense of what did you do next? What protocols were in place or did you improvise on the fly essentially activating the Air Force or notifying somebody?
Well, I think just like anybody else with 30 years of experience, once you realize pretty much what's happened, even if you don't know the details, your training, 30 years of training kicks in. And, the first thing that occurred to me was that if something's coming back toward the Pentagon, we need to keep our people safe. So having taken care of that and telling the people as they walked out the door to go up and get their people away from the E-ring, as soon as you do that, come back down here, because the next thing we have to do after that is start to prepare for whatever the next steps are. And so that was immediately on my mind. As far as our responsibilities, we had to get the team back together. We had to make sure that the alternate command center, which is over at Bowling Air Force Base, was ready to accept us. And make sure that the things that you're responsible for are actually happening. We have a big role in continuity of government in that we have a helicopter stationed at Andrews that disperse our political leadership in accordance with the plan. It's all prepared, done by plan and checklist. And just to make sure that all those things are properly underway, that the right information has been communicated to people who have to make a decision. And as the chief of staff, making sure that as we execute automatically those things we're supposed to execute, that no one has held their hand up and exercised a power of veto that says, no, we have to wait until we learn more, or we need to slow this down. There are things that have to happen, and that's what we made sure. Among them, of course, is Air Force One. Where's Air Force One? Where's the president? Not that I'm controlling any of it, but just making sure that we've got a handle on these things. The bulk of the responsibility, of course, laid with Ed Eberhard out at NORAD, and he's now worrying about the airspace, initial steps to decide what we're going to do about the airspace, about the fumbles in coordination with FAA, getting the sort of information that Heather talked about with airplanes sort of heading in the wrong direction initially, going by their plans. Finally, it was just getting on the line to my counterparts, the other chiefs, and figuring out making sure the team's together. That the Joint Chiefs of Staff is still the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Nobody's been hurt, and then taking steps to be as much help as we possibly can in the immediate crisis there in New York. So, we sent a tactical hospital up to McGuire Air Force Base that came out of Langley. We set that up because we thought there'd be hundreds, if not thousands, of people injured, and of course they weren't. They were all mostly killed. We sent the hospital up there. We put our available special ops helicopters up there, and we ended up being sort of the command center for FEMA because we had this elaborate setup that was ready to go, and they used it. So those were sort of the initial things that happened.
And how about you, General Deptula?
Well, the alarms went off almost immediately after the aircraft impact. And I went from my office to my execs right outside my door and contacted our divisions and told them to get out. I told my exec to ensure that all our Air Force Quadrennial Defense Review people were notified and accounted for. And then after a bit of time, excuse me, he let me know that they were. So my exec and I headed downstairs to the main Pentagon exit, but the police had blocked that exit off. In the process, I'd run into Lieutenant General Ray Hewitt, who suggested that we try the river entrance. So we headed over to the river entrance along the A-ring, watching the west side burn across the courtyard. It was a real zoo in the context of people crowding the halls everywhere. And somewhere in that confusion that followed, I got a hold of the Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, General Lance Lord, who is my immediate supervisor, to find out what he wanted me to do next. As a Quadrennial Defense Review Director, I was not in a critical billet, so he told me to go home. So my exec and I split up as he tried to find his car, and I figured there could be another strike. So I walked away from the Pentagon over to the yacht basin across the river entrance, and there tried to call my wife and others to no avail, as the cell phone lines were all dead. And so that was kind of the immediate aftermath of what happened.
You know, when you say that, sir, it just immediately makes me think back to as frustrating as it is in 2021 to try to make a cell phone call sometimes, that obviously our cell towers were not very robust back then as well. So, and now, Heather, you are over at the fighter squadron. Can you give us an idea of what's happening there? You obviously know about the strikes in New York. What chain of events played out at the squadron, and did you guys think that the National Capital Region would be the next target?
So, Slick, we absolutely had to make the assumption that the National Capital Region would be a natural target, because we'd already seen two strikes. We didn't know how many others were airborne, and we had to make that assumption. So we knew that we needed to launch. We knew we needed to protect. We knew we needed to defend. So as I said before, our two major problems was getting the authorization to launch, because, I mean, as the military, we have to have the appropriate command, especially with what was on the stakes here. Civilian airliners with Americans on board are the hostiles. So there's no way that we could have just launched on our own with that being the situation, right? We needed to have the authorization and consent of our civilian leadership. You know, but the other part of it, yeah, but the other part of that too was we couldn't get launched and contribute to the chaos and confusion. So if people didn't know that we were good guys and that we were launching as part of that response, we could actually make a bad situation worse. So that's one piece. We have to work up the chain of command. The other piece is we have to get missiles built up, because you don't, you know, we're not flying around in training with live missiles on board. And we also don't store them, you know, in Saran wrap that you just unzip lock and put up on a jet. So they've got to get built like Legos, right? So you got to put the explosives and the warhead and the fins and the rocket body and all that together. So we had to do that. The squadron leadership was willing, you know, Mark Sasseville, who was our director of operations. So he's the senior leader at the time of the squadron, our wing commander, David Worley. So they're like, this is what we need to do. Dan Kane, who's our weapons officer, calls down to the bomb dump and tells him, I need you to build up some AIM-9s, some heaters, and make them live. I need real missiles and get them as quickly as you possibly can to the squadron. So as they're working that, so General Worley is trying to do our traditional chain of command. And as I mentioned, General Sasseville and Phil Dog Thompson was our supervisor of flying. The two of them are trying to kind of short circuit our chain of command to try to get authorization from the White House. And they're calling our air traffic control tower at Andrews Air Force Base. They're trying to get a hold of the Secret Service, because if we think that if we can get a hold of the Secret Service, maybe they can get through to our leadership, the president, someone on his staff that'll be able to allow us to get airborne.
So when did you actually get the word to launch, and who made the call, and why did they pick you to go? As I understand it, you were pretty junior at the time.
We didn't get the word to launch until too late. The Pentagon had already been hit, and it wasn't until Vice President Cheney said, you know, aren't there fighters at Andrews? Somebody get them airborne. So the White House jock actually called us and said, what can you get airborne? And that's when Mark Sasseville looked at me and said, lucky you're with me. Let's go. So his plan was to ram his jet into the cockpit to take out the flight controls, to take out the terrorists, And I would take the tail, because without the tail, without the empennage, you know, an aircraft becomes unbalanced and it can't fly, literally just tips over and goes straight into the ground. I've never asked Sass why he chose me. I mean, I was very junior. I was a wingman at the time. But part of it was that he needed his more experienced flight leads, like Raisin, and we had Drifter Valentine had just shown up to the squadron, so another, you know, weapons officer. He needed that senior experience to lead the next tranche of flights that would be taking off. So, I mean, because we knew that if we were successful, this would be a suicide mission, there was no reason to take out two experienced, qualified flight leads.
Gotcha. Well, talk about leadership, making decisions and running everything through their mind. But did you know what target you were going after? And did you know, obviously you talked about the tactics, but did you know exactly where you're going and what you're going up against?
Because David McNulty, our intelligence officer, had been working with the FAA and he'd been calling Potomac TRACON, so the radar facility for the air traffic control in the DC area, and talking to the airlines, we actually believed that there were up to three unaccounted for aircraft. And when the White House jock called us, they also let us know that there was a potential hostile inbound from the Pennsylvania area. They had seen, the FAA had seen an aircraft descend, turn off its transponder, and then make a 180-degree turn back towards the D.C. area. So we knew that that was the attack axis. So that's what we were going after. It wasn't until much later that we made the correlation that was Flight 93.
Wow. Now, General Jumper, as this is all going on, you're back in the Pentagon as a chief of staff, and you had talked about your initial response. General Deptula had mentioned it with the cell phone towers being down. And what was information flow like? I mean, how is it going? How are you executing? And how was C2 being exercised at this point?
Well, we had command and control. I mean, we had the red switch for our normal conversations, which is a sort of a button press. It worked the entire time, at least for me. And so the command centers then were hooked up hardline to the alternate command post at Bowling. So we were getting hardline communications as they received information. They would pass it along. And we were just sitting there gathering the information. The slowest to come, of course, was the intel, because we were scrambling to figure out what was really going on. As Heather pointed out, how many airplanes were really airborne and taking part of this? Was this something that was going to be nationwide? Were there 20 or 30 of these things coordinated? If there could be one, two, or three, there could be more. And so there was a lot of filtering and confusion, but you also know exactly what it is you're supposed to be doing, and that's we were in contact with the commands to make sure that those things were happening.
Yeah, it takes a whole different perspective on the fog and friction of war, right? And with that, General Deptula, you mentioned, you know, physically being outside of the Pentagon at this point. Can you paint the picture for us? I mean, you saw it firsthand. What did it look like?
Well, Slick, it was surreal is the best way to describe it. One of the first things that became evident was the silence. Now, the Pentagon's on the approach departure path of Washington National Airport. And once you step outside, there's loud jet noise almost constantly from all the air traffic. That particular day, there was no noise. But looking up, there were a pair of F-16s capping the airspace over Washington. Heather was up there. I didn't know her at the time. And smoke was billowing from the Pentagon. The picture was stark. Helicopters were coming and going from the river entrance, but the rest of the place was blocked off. By and by, several reporters showed up at the marina there across from the river entrance and started asking me questions. And a resident of the marina got out a small television, and that's how we saw the first tower fall. But having accounted for all our QDR-directed personnel and directing them to go home, I started to walk over to my deputy's townhouse, which was located just 100 yards from where we are today here in the Air Force Association headquarters building. As I was walking down, I forget which road it was, but I got a lift from a random driver. And as I was driving with him, I saw General Bath, Major General Craig McKinley, and a couple others walking down the side of the road. So I told the driver, hey, pull over, let's pick those guys up. So we picked him up, and the driver took us over to Ron's house, and there via landline, I was able to call my dad in Florida, who then called my wife to let her know I was okay. And then I finally got home about 3 p.m.
My goodness. Well, Heather, last point we were chatting, we left you in life support and ready to run out to your jet. So can you walk us through those moments and what it was like to launch? And obviously, you know, there's no training for this.
Walk through the moment, more like run through the moment. I mean, SAS and I sprinted out of the operations building down across the little picnic area. And I remember, again, how bright blue the sky was and the sunlight dappling through the trees. I had not been trained to scramble because, I mean, we were in a post-Cold War world. I'd never sat nuke alert. Now, SAS had been trained because he had had to sit nuke alert, so he knew how to scramble a jet, but I didn't. And so I would just have to rely on my own systems knowledge of my aircraft to do the minimum necessary to get the engine started, do the one essential check on the engine, and then do the one essential check on the digital flight control system, and leave. I mean, it normally takes about 20 minutes to get the jet all woken up, and this is in the age before GPS, right? So I didn't have a radar. I didn't have any of my weapon systems. I didn't have a navigation platform. And SAS is already starting to taxi, and I'm getting ready to jump the chocks in afterburner. I'm yelling, pull the chocks. And suddenly the crew chief yanks the chocks out, and I lurch forward. And he's actually, his comm cord is still plugged into the jet. And as I follow after SAS, I can see him and other crew chiefs pulling pins out of my gear, pulling the pins out of my TERS, pulling the pins out of my external fuel tanks. And the last thing that my crew chief says to me is Godspeed when he pulls the comm cord. And I followed SAS down taxiway Echo for a rolling takeoff on runway 1R. And we took off to the northwest towards Pennsylvania over the Pentagon.
So Heather, there you are, climbing at altitude. How did you know where to go? Who were you talking to? What was C2 like? And, you know, were there other fighters doing the same thing that you guys were doing?
We didn't climb high. We stayed low because we knew the target was low. We had seen, you know, what was going on with the aircraft that had attacked the trade centers, the aircraft that attacked the Pentagon. So, and we knew that the inbound airliner was attempting to evade radar and staying low as well. So we knew that the threat was coming from the northwest. So that's why we headed down the Potomac. That's what the jock from the White House had told us. And frankly, we didn't have any real C2. All we were talking to was Potomac departure. It was the FAA traffic control, with them trying to do their best to point us in the right direction. But there was no command authority. There was no mother may I. When we got the word from the White House saying, what can you do to get airborne? That was our authorization.
And so there you are. When did you know that the aircraft in question that you were going after had crashed in Pennsylvania?
We didn't get word that that target had crashed until after we had landed off after the first sortie. So SAS took us out to the northwest on that azimuth to sanitize the airspace. We probably went, I don't know, I'm guessing here, maybe 100 miles before, you know, making sure that the threat was not out there. But we couldn't go even further because then we would risk leaving DC unprotected. So SAS calls Ranch House. He brings us back over DC and sets us up on a counter-rotating cap. And we're talking with Potomac. They're essentially acting as our air battle managers. They are telling us who's who in the battle space. They're telling us what contacts are unknowns. Because remember, there was still general aviation flying around. And this is before you got news alerts on a phone, right? I mean, this is barely cell phone land. There's no smartphones. So if you watched the 6:30 a.m. news that morning and then got up and went to the airport, you had no idea that we were living in a completely different universe, completely different world.
Got it. Well, General Jumper, how did the mission evolve from your vantage point as the morning transpired? And who was making calls, and how are individual units being tasked?
Well, of course, those all come through command chain. So, you know, NORAD, Ed Eberhardt at NORAD was, after shutting down the airspace, was then dealing with the situation of getting airplanes safely on the ground through the FAA, making sure that, you know, Air Force One was doing what we understood what it was going to do. And, of course, the president was making the decisions about how he was going to position himself, making sure that the continuity of government was actually completed the way that it's supposed to be. All those things those are pretty much on automatic. I was sort of confirming that, and then making sure we had the right connections with Central Command, that we had our planning staffs ready and energized to help and cooperate as soon as the situation, the Pentagon settled down. As Dave said, you know, they were scattered out. A lot of them went home and really only had sort of a commercial view of what was going on, but nobody could do anything until we got the Pentagon cleared to work again, and we got our command communications squared away so that we understood that all the steps that were planned to be taken were indeed taken. It's interesting. An interesting aside is I told you that I'd gone down to Langley and packed up the household goods, and my wife Ellen was in the car in front of the moving van that morning coming in. As she approached Washington, she'd been listening to music on the CD player. She approached Washington and saw the smoke rising from the Pentagon. She turned on the news, and that was the first time she knew what was happening. She turned the truck around because we'd been stationed in Washington several times. She knew how to sort of worm her way over to Fort Myer, where our house was. My youngest daughter was staying with General and Mrs. Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and going to be our next door neighbor. So she was in school, and my security folks were smart enough to go get her out of school and collect her, because by that time they knew that I was all right, but Ellen didn't, because you couldn't get through to Ellen on the cell phone. So finally all that got squared away, but that was another little sort of domestic emergency I was having to deal with at the same time that was pretty much on my mind until Ellen knew I was okay.
Wow. And so, General Deptula, how did the events at the Pentagon continue to develop?
I was back at work in the Pentagon the next day, working QDR issues and checking my notes from that day. I was upset that Paula Zahn, a reporter at CNN, was reporting about an aircraft carrier off the coast, but ignoring the Air Force fighters flying combat air patrols overhead. Some things never change. I was preparing to meet with Congressman Thornberry the next day to discuss Air Force transformation, and then got started with contingency planning right off the bat. Meanwhile, sometime in the late morning, we were told to evacuate the building. So I went over to our QDR office in Ballston, but came back to the Pentagon the next day when I was asked to go down to checkmate and assist in concept development for a response against Al-Qaeda. I could talk for hours about this. I've got all my notes, but in the interest of time, I'll just summarize all that went on, in that I had a meeting with Chief Jumper that afternoon to review some of the initial campaign concepts around 1700.
Unbelievable. Well, you know, as we've talked before with Desert Storm and you being the, you know, one of the architects of that, and there you are again in the Pentagon being asked to plan. So thank goodness we had you there. Heather, what did the rest of your day look like, and how did your mission evolve over the course of the day? I also understand you escorted Air Force One back to D.C.
Yeah, so Sass and I stayed airborne, I think if I remember right, nearly 4 hours because of the tankers that the Quits had brought with them, and then they had brought an E-3 AWACS with them as well. It was on the second sortie that that we escorted Air Force One back to D.C., but you know, what was even more significant about that was that during the course of the first sortie, as the four of us are airborne, we ended up getting a free fire authorization. So instead of having to ask Mother May I to employ lethal force, this was our first real official communication of owning the missile and owning the decision to use and employ that lethal force And we had to, you know, really that was the only way to be able to do it, because the battle space was so chaotic, because it was so confusing, because the stakes were so high, being here on American soil, and because of how broken that whole C2 chain was. And it really is, I think, not only a testament to the leadership of the Air Force at the time, that they were willing to make that authorization for free fire, weapons free, and delegate that choice down to the fighter pilots, but it's also, you know, to me, an indication of the professionalism and the restraint, because even though everyone's emotions were really high, no one took advantage of that. So there were no mistakes made. We went out, we did a visual identification, we bunted a lot of aircraft away from the DC AOR, but no one got trigger happy. And so the ability and the willingness of the command leadership at the time to make that weapons-free call, to take the risk to be able to do that rather than the insurance of owning that mother may I, and the professionalism, to me, just it really demonstrates the character of the force at the time.
Yeah, and we obviously have talked about how that pendulum swung the other way, and fighter pilots were not allowed to make a lot of decisions on dropping ordnance when they knew that we needed to save lives. But I will refocus back to General Jumper. How about you, now that you have the admin squared away and of course the domestic admin squared away with your wife, how did the rest of your day unfold?
Well, we just spent the rest of the day making sure that the right connections were made and making arrangements to go back into the Pentagon. As Dave said, quickly organized ourselves with our advanced planning force we have in the Pentagon to plug them into the right people to make sure that with full knowledge we could employ and deploy and prepare our assets to do the job they needed to do. And then we sort of went into the wartime planning mode then. And communications with Central Command, with our air component, and making sure that they had everything we could make available to start the planning process, or whatever the reaction was going to be. That was the rest of that day, the next day when we came back to the Pentagon, and the days that followed. Meetings in the tank, of course, meetings with Secretary of Defense, making sure that we were able to communicate specifically what our response was and our preparedness for the next steps.
And General Deptula, I know that you wrapped up 9/11 and the initial day following going back on the QDR, but can you walk us through how those events shaped the next few weeks of what you'd be in charge of doing?
Well, I already covered the rest of the 11th earlier, but you might find it of interest that the next couple of days we're back to work on wrapping up the QDR, and as General Jumper indicated, seriously starting contingency planning for America's response. I was in touch with Lieutenant General Chuck Wald, who was then the 9th Air Force commander, as well as with the folks down in Checkmate. My initial assessment of the early CENTCOM plans was that they were, and this is diplomatic language, unimaginative and too gradual. But the interesting twist for me was a couple of days after 9/11, I got a call from Chief Jumper, who asked me to come down to his office. Now, that wasn't very unusual because, you know, QDR wrapping up, we almost met daily. But I did go down there, and when I got down there, he told me that he'd just gotten a call from Chuck Wald asking him if he would release me to come to the Mideast to become the commander of the Air and Space Operations Center to plan the air response to the 9/11 attacks. And so General Jumper asked me if I wanted to go. I don't know what the expression on my face was, but I enthusiastically said, "Of course." "Okay, you got it," he said. And I was, as I was walking out the door of his office, he hollered out to me some typical fighter pilot advice: "Don't screw up." But he used fighter pilot language, but I cleaned it up for the audience. And so about 10 days after, I'm sitting at my desk working the finishing touches on the Quadrennial Defense Review, I find myself at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia planning the takedown of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
It's unreal. Absolutely unreal. Well, now I've asked each of you about your respective roles, but I know each one of you saw tremendous acts of bravery and determination all around you. Anybody have any stories they want to share?
Well, I mean, I never felt, after the airplane hit the Pentagon, I never felt my life was threatened. The real hero here is Heather and her colleagues over in the 121st and all those that went airborne. You know, it never, I was in on the decision to go weapons free. And there was never any doubt in my mind we were doing the right thing with that. Anybody who's dealt with our airmen over the years and are aware of the sort of training we go through to prepare for eventualities that are surprises, which almost every combat mission has at least one or two surprises. Know that we have the right kind of airmen to make those decisions. So that was an easy decision. I know that there were people who ran out to the fire and help pull people out. All that was, I didn't witness that. I figured my duty station was getting the Air Force organized to do what it could do. But I think the whole response in the air that day to a situation that no one had anticipated, and the prospect of having to shoot down American airliners and American airspace full of Americans was something that everybody was prepared to do their duty. I know they were, as hard as that would be, just like Heather. And I think that that is the greatest testimony to the quality of our airmen that I could ever see.
I really don't have anything to add. I think General Jumper summed up our feelings very, very well.
All right, Heather, you were on the flight line, so I'm sure you've got some stories there.
You know, it's amazing. Everything from the transformation of what the squadron looked like in the morning, where it was just a skeleton crew. I mean, we didn't even bother turning all the lights on in the building, right, because there were so few people there. To the time when Sass and I landed after our second sortie, it was buzzing. There were cots all over. We were turning into a 24/7 operation. And all of our part-time guardsmen who had gone, you know, they were at their normal jobs. When they heard the news of the trade centers of the Pentagon, they got up, told their bosses their nation needed them, and they came to the base. And the bar had transformed from, you know, cold popcorn and hot coffee to a buffet again to enable 24/7 operations. Wives were bringing in casseroles. It was amazing, that transformation. And you think about all of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, I mean all of the service members who flooded the recruiters to answer their nation's call afterwards, right? But to me, the real story of the bravery and determination, I mean, clearly I have this connection to the passengers on Flight 93, because as ordinary, everyday Americans, they answered the call too, by taking down the terrorists, taking down that airliner to protect our nation's capital. They answered the call. That to me demonstrates sort of that latent notion of service. I mean, we talk about the greatest generation of World War II. I don't think that DNA is dead, but we just need to reconnect to it.
Incredibly powerful, Heather. Thanks for sharing that. All right, so I'd like to open it up to any last thoughts that anybody has to take away from the session. Any lessons learned?
Well, the lessons learned became obvious. We were not at all prepared to be able to deal with threats that were generated internally. We, of course, fixed the initial communications problems we had with FAA. I think in the world we live in today that there's probably no room left for surprises. I think that we've seen enough surprises around the world unfold that we're pretty much ready for anything. And, of course, the thing that we're all left with is this indelible awareness of the radical threat that we're got to be prepared for every single day. And with current events, I think we need to be prepared for that to that threat to even be more dominant in our daily lives.
Yeah, I would just add that while this was a bolt out of the blue attack, the system responded rapidly and pretty well, adapted pretty well. As General Jumper said, corrections were put in place to address internal defense, not just external defense. And the magnitude of the changes put in place are still affecting all Americans today. Think TSA. So one of the takeaways is that the 9/11 attacks demonstrated the impact of an effects-based attack. Unfortunately, we were the recipients. The second major lesson really didn't manifest itself immediately, but at the strategic level, critical U.S. security objectives must be clearly identified, adhered to, and when accomplished, appropriate action taken. Real briefly, in Afghanistan, we met our critical U.S. national security interests by the end of 2001. We had removed the Taliban from power. We assisted a new government protecting our interests and those of the Afghani people. And finally, we eliminated the al-Qaeda's terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. The trillion-dollar question is, why did the U.S. not declare victory then and there? Now, that's a political question. And there are several answers to that. But one of them is that the dogma of ground-centric joint doctrine inhibited the realization that our objectives had been achieved. So in early to mid-2002, we should have said, hey, we're out of here. See you later. Have a nice life. But if you do it again, we'll be back. Instead, we poured hundreds of thousands of ground forces into Afghanistan over the next two decades after these vital national security interests were achieved. There's a lot that can be said about this, but again, I want to go back to emphasize the importance of defining clear objectives and once accomplishing them, moving on.
You know, when I think back to 9/11, part of what I think about is the context of that. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, post-Cold War, we became complacent. We began to build, we literally cut the Air Force in half. To achieve cost savings, right? So again, budget-driven, but we wanted to demobilize and return to a peacetime world, even though the world was not peacetime. So we were posturing for a world that we wanted to believe in, not the world that really existed. So now fast forward to today, I share that same concern. Back then, you know, we lacked the imagination and the gumption to face the realities of what the national security threats were. And I worry about repeating those errors today. Now that we've left Afghanistan and in many ways are retreating from the Middle East, I think that I worry about our nation being war-weary and wanting to reap some kind of peace dividend. And again, going back to a position where they cut the Air Force and they cut the military and really posture for a world that we want to believe in, not the world that actually exists, when in fact we have a much more complex and dangerous world than we did on September 10th of 2001. And so we cannot let our imaginations fail. We cannot become complacent, and we have to be able to rise to the challenge to continue to ensure that the Pax Americana that has existed essentially since post-World War II continues.
Yeah, Heather, that's such an outstanding point, and I know that we will be laser focused at Mitchell to ensure that we do not repeat history, end up with a hollow Air Force after 20 years of war in the Middle East, and allow our country to become vulnerable again. So thank goodness we are all focused on this. We'll make sure that we continue to beat that drum. So with that, I'd like to thank General Jumper, General Deptula, and of course, Heather, for being here and sharing your thoughts with us. I know this is a difficult subject, but I also think it's really important that we educate folks on what happened. While we hold this history close, we now have generations serving in the military today and in our society who were not even alive when the attacks occurred. So we cannot forget the sacrifice, dedication to duty, and lessons from that day. All right. So I'd love to thank you all for being here. General Jumper, thanks so much for your time.
Glad to participate today. Thank you.
And General Deptula, always great to hear your insights.
Yeah, thanks, Slick. It's always wonderful to be on a show with Chief of Staff, General Jumper, and as well as with Heather.
And of course, Heather, thanks so much for your bravery that day and for sharing your story with us.
Slick, thank you. And it's a privilege to have been here with you all.
With that,
I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.